Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Joe Ligand, author of the new book, Wherever You Go. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As you probably know, we Jews have holidays all the time, so adding another one to our calendar seems almost too easy. Now, I'm not saying all the holidays themselves are easy, of course. For example, the holiday coming up this week, Tisha B'Av, the fast day of the ninth of Av, which starts at sundown on Monday night, involves not eating or drinking for 24 long hours on a hot summer day as we mourn the destruction of the first and second temples long ago. But the notion of extra Jewish holidays seems, well, no problem. I mean, what's another festival when you already have a dozen or so? But next week, right here on the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, we're celebrating a unique and very, very special holiday. That's right. Next week, we have a big Two Jewish anniversary coming up, our ninth anniversary show. Now, we haven't rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem or anything quite like that, but still, 9 years. My goodness, Gewalt! Have we been doing this for 9 years now? I mean, most jobs don't last that long, especially these days. Most marriages don't last that long, at least not in America. Actually, that's not exactly true. Currently, you may be pleased to note that 65% of marriages actually make it to the 10th anniversary. I'm not sure this is exactly cause for rejoicing, but still, that means that Two Jewish has lasted longer than 35% of the marriages. Well, then I read another statistic that said actually the average length of a marriage in the U.S. has been reported at just 8 years. So on second thought, we have lasted longer than most marriages. And since my friends, Walker Ford, our producer, and Tom Price, our maven on Israel, have been with me for all 9 years, in fact, since our second or third show, our relationship has lasted longer than lots of marriages. I choose not to speculate on the meaning of that, by the way, but I do encourage you to come back next week with all of us and celebrate this wonderful anniversary in true Two Jewish style. But enough about next week. Life is to live, the Yiddish proverb has it, so let's live today like there's no tomorrow, or at least no next week. In that spirit, to play us in this morning, here's a musical cut from my old friends, the Ellis Island Klezmer Band, the classic Yiddish song, De Grine Cousine. It's all about a new immigrant to the new world, just as we were new immigrants to the new world of radio 9 years ago. Oops, that's next week.
die besangen Jahren, wie mein Cousine ist auch da geboren. Hey, das hat sie wochenlang geblieben, bis mir ist gar nicht geblieben. Hey, das hat sie wochenlang geblieben. Mein Cousine, und ich frage, was machst du etwas grün? Sind sie ab und rein in der Mine? Brandes und Kolumbus und Medine. Sind sie ab und rein in der Mine? Brandes und Kolumbus und Medine.
That was the classic Negrina Cousina. While usually that's taken to be an upbeat and fun tune about a pretty new immigrant girl, which it sort of is, it's actually a protest song of the 1920s in a Yiddish mode. You see, over time, that song tells us, in the tough economic climate and brutal work conditions in New York, this beautiful girl, this Grina Cousina, with the flashing black eyes and ruby red lips and dancing feet, gets worn down and defeated by life. Well, the more things change in this world, the more they stay the same. But life is not just filled with economic hard times now or with sad stories. We're happy to report here on Too Jewish that last week in San Francisco, the judge cut the circumcision ban right off the ballot. That's right. For those of you who have been following this troublesome issue over the past few months here on Too Jewish, the danger of someone cutting out Brit Milah has now been excised. San Francisco Superior Court, San Francisco Superior Court Judge Loretta Georgie struck a measure from the city's November ballot that called for a ban on most circumcisions of male children, saying the proposed law violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of religious freedom and the California state law that makes regulating medical procedures a function of the state, not the city. The ruling confirmed a tentative decision she issued a day before and came after she heard arguments from proponents of the ban, which would have made San Francisco the first U.S. city to hold a public vote on whether to outlaw the circumcision of minors. Georgie, while acknowledging that there is legitimate debate on the benefits or harms of circumcision, ordered San Francisco's elections director to remove the measure from the ballot. "I don't think there's any debate. This matter relates to issues of statewide concern," she said. The Citizens Initiative, which qualified for the ballot back in May, would have made the practice a misdemeanor, punishable by a fine of up to $1,000 or up to 1 year in jail. It did not offer exemptions for religious rituals like a Jewish bris or a Muslim chitan. The San Francisco City Attorney's Office joined several Jewish organizations and Muslim parents in challenging the ban in court. Well, we can just cut out the worrying. That is a relief for Jews everywhere. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, the fine author Joan Ligant, whose new book, Wherever You Go, is one of the most important Jewish books of this year. Find out why when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means, nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish Joan Ligon, the author of Wherever You Go, a novel, a hot new Jewish novel of the year. She's also the author of An Hour in Paradise, the winner of the Penn New England Book Award, the Wallant Award for Jewish Fiction, and a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. She taught writing at Harvard for 8 years. I'm sorry you couldn't find a better school to teach at, really.
I'm lucky I live in Boston.
And since 2007, she's lived half the year in Israel, which no doubt played a big role in her new novel. Good morning, Joan. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Good. Thank you very much. Good morning.
My pleasure. Talk a little bit about the conception on your new novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm one of these writers who doesn't start with so much a theme or an idea, but just some characters. But having said that, I did start with the idea. I was interested in exploring three Americans when they come to Israel. I wanted to know what happens to them when they come. What are the pushes and pulls, the influences, what directions they might go in. But underneath all of that, apart from my interest in the characters, is that I have had a longstanding interest in people who were drawn to radical causes. And it's not an accident that my characters did pull me straight into the heart of some of the most controversial or complicated political issues in Israel regarding the settlements, settlers out in the West Bank, the most extreme settlers, that is, that small swath but influential number of individuals who are out in the West Bank. So I was interested in following, as I say, young Americans, and this is where some of them went, and that allowed me to explore this question of what drives people to embrace extremism, what allows them to justify violence in the name of a cause, and most particularly, what allows them to justify violence in the name of religion. That's interesting to me. So I wanted to explore it through the book.
You know, it's an important question, of course, across the board right now, violence in the name of religion. Maybe it has always been an important question. Have you gotten any flack for exploring it so intimately from the Jewish side of the question?
I wouldn't say huge flack. I say that I've been to lots of communities to speak, but the communities who I think would have the most objection wouldn't invite me, so I didn't necessarily go to those places.
Kind of self-selecting there,
yeah,
isn't it?
Right. So I found sort of two things. I did get some pushback an occasional like angry email or an irritated review where somebody once wrote in one of them, well, it was actually a settler who wrote this review for an Israeli newspaper, said, well, she's out to get us. You know, we're such easy targets. I mean, I got some of that. Occasionally I got people asking, why would you, we know this exists in Israel, we know it's important, but we're American Jews and we're worried. Why are you showing this side of Israel that isn't the positive side? Mm-hmm. You know, couldn't you use your talents and abilities, or however they put it, to show a positive side? And this goes straight to the heart of what you do as a fiction writer, too. Your job as a fiction writer isn't necessarily to make people happy, but it's to explore something that you think is significant. So I got some interesting responses like that. People who complimented the book, even, who said, this is a good book, but I wish you hadn't written it because it's making me uncomfortable.
We will explore what it means to make people uncomfortable, because people say the same thing. I want Judaism to make, I want temple to make me feel comfortable. And I had a professor who once said, I thought the job of religion was to make the comfortable people uncomfortable and the uncomfortable people comfortable. We'll talk about that and many other things with the incredibly articulate, excellent writer Joan Ligant when we come back on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Anne are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch Rukfel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can get all past and present shows there or download us as very popular podcasts at the Apple iTunes Store. Oh, it's free there, by the way. A very interesting guy passed away last week. His name was Milton Gewurzman. I'm pretty sure you've never heard of him. I hadn't. But he was an important Washington insider and power broker for 50 years. His story is pretty interesting. After finishing summa cum laude at Harvard, Ted Kennedy was a classmate. He went to Yale Law School and edited its law journal. He then moved into politics, eventually becoming a speechwriter for former President Harry Truman. And then in 1959, Gewurzman was a young aide to Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri when Ted Sorensen, John F. Kennedy's lieutenant, hired him as deputy director of research for Kennedy's presidential campaign. More about that in a minute. He later joined Edward Kennedy's successful 1962 campaign for the Senate and continued to advise the senator afterwards while he practiced law. In 1964, Robert F. Kennedy asked him for a memorandum on whether he should run for senator from New York or governor of Massachusetts. Gewurzman recommended the Senate race, which Bobby Kennedy chose and won. Gewurzman was his chief speechwriter. When Kennedy ran for president, Gewurzman was now the campaign's director of public affairs. In 72, he wrote speeches for George McGovern's campaign, less successful, and in the 76 campaign, he was an advisor to Jimmy Carter. Within the Kennedy family, Gewurzman's strategizing, loyalty, and oracular reputation made him a legend. Likening him to a wizard, a family saying of the Kennedys had it that you can only see him if you believe in him. And the Kennedys believed. Gewurzman shows up repeatedly in histories of the Kennedys. He helped John F. Kennedy prepare for his presidential debates with Richard Nixon. He helped persuade Robert F. Kennedy to run for the Senate. He became one of his top aides when he was running for president, and he helped write some of Teddy Kennedy's best speeches, including his eulogy in 1968 for Robert at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York after his assassination. It was this fellow, Milt Gewurzman, who wrote an oft-quoted passage in which Senator Kennedy said, "My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it." As a special advisor to Stuart Eisenstadt, Under Secretary of the Treasury, Milt Gewurzman worked on a legal settlement between Holocaust victims and German industry, in which 1.6 million survivors who had been worked as Nazi slaves received $8 billion in compensation. Well, for not having known this guy, you've heard a lot, but his best story was when Gewurzman was a young operative in the 1960 Kennedy presidential campaign. Ted Sorensen asked him to find out how many Catholics had died at the Alamo fighting for Texas. John F. Kennedy had visited the site, and Sorensen thought the Texas reference would be helpful at a speech the candidate was giving in Houston to Protestant ministers who were uneasy about the prospect of a Roman Catholic president. The best Gewurzman could find was a list of Alamo fighters whose names suggested they might have been Catholics, although he couldn't say for sure. Kaversman said Ted Sorensen made lemonade out of these lemons. In his address to the ministers, Kennedy said, "For side by side with Bowie and Crockett died Fuentes and McCafferty and Bailey and Badillo and Carey. But no one knows whether they were Catholics or not, for there was no religious test at the Alamo." What a fabulous story. And a great way to think about America, too. Even if it was, well, very creative. Apparently, there is no religious test for the Kennedys, either. May Milt Gewurzman rest in peace.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So it's time to go back to school. Tell us what it's like to go back to school in Israel. We know what it's like to go back to school in America, most of us.
Well, first of all, you go back to school in Israel on 1st of September and not in mid-August. That's the first change. The second thing is...
Since I'm from California, I never understood going back to school in mid-August. But here in Arizona, there we are. It's hot, it's humid, then we're back in school. Okay, go ahead.
Now, the second very important element in going back to school in Israel is that the month of September is usually the high holidays. And all Israeli schools are what you call here Jewish schools. So you have vacations all across the first months of school. So, yeah, the vacation, the summer vacation is over. You go back to school 5 days, 6 days. You go on another vacation for Rosh Hashanah. You come back to school for 3 more days. Go on vacation for Yom Kippur. Come back to school. Go for another vacation for entire Sukkot.
The whole week. You're off the whole week.
It's
great.
Yeah, it's a really hard month for the students. Really, really.
So you really get to ease back into school in a way we don't get to enjoy so much in the States.
Yes. Now, for the teachers, on the other hand, it's really a challenge because they have very few days that they're expected to teach about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, to bring all the tradition to life. But that's make this month very, very intensive in Jewish culture. And I really like it, to be honest. And before going to school, all the preparations, going to, you know, like here, going to buy the pencils, the all those notebooks and stuff that kids need for school.
Getting them their laptops, you know, all the stuff we do nowadays.
Yeah, well, any way you can get parents to spend more money works, that's you know. It. That's how it goes in Israel. That's how it goes here. So that's how going back to school. One other difference, I think, is school buses. While in the States, you have the yellow bus, who is very geared only for students, right? In Israel, most students go to school on public buses. And when you have a first grader or a second grader, it's always a challenge. How do you teach your kid how to go on the bus, how to pay the money for the ride? He doesn't know mathematics yet. How does he know how much to pay for the bus? You know, so it's always a challenge. And always in the big cities, finding the safe route to school, showing them how they can get to school without crossing roads and stuff, so they will be safe traffic-wise. I guess you have that here also.
You know, we do, but it's much more... I think Americans are coddled more. Not all of us, but a lot of us think... You know, there's a certain expectation of maturity in Israel with kids. Isn't always met, but much more so than the United States. I also have to say that Sukkot holiday is fantastic because the weather in Israel is gorgeous at Sukkot. And you get a vacation not long after starting school, and it's a good time to be on vacation there.
Yeah, it is. And if you're a father, that means you need to build a sukkah.
Yeah.
Because any real father in Israel builds a sukkah, and not the ones that you buy out at, here, I don't know, Walmart.
Home Depot. Lowe's or something, right?
But the one that you really bring wood and nails and, you know, you really build it, or else you don't look macho enough. So, yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that when we get to Sukkot. Welcome back to school, and we'll talk next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weidler of Janos Restaurant and the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So what's going on this summer at Janos and the J-Bar?
We've got so much going on, it's hard for me to keep it all straight, but I'm going to try. We've got our summer music series that you know about. We have our summer passports where you dine, and the more times you dine, you collect stamps for free dinners at Janos or J-Bar. Our Janos summer samplers at $19.95, our J-Bar summer samplers at $12.95. At Janos, our 10 terrific taste menu, four courses, 12 different items for $50, drink specials, wine specials. Summer's our time.
I'm starving.
Well, come on over, Rabbi.
What's the phone number for Janos and the J-Bar?
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com. We've got all our menus up. We've got the summer music schedule up.
And don't forget all the great samplers. We will see you at Janos and the J-Bar, J-A-N-O-S.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene for all of our long history on this anniversary show, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
A shared mazel tov.
The pleasure has been all mine.
And our listeners, and mine. We were talking a little while ago about some of the laws that have passed in Europe outlawing kosher slaughter, shechita, in Scandinavia. A law just passed at the end of June in Holland. It goes to the Dutch Senate now, outlawing kosher slaughter on the grounds that theoretically it's not humanitarian enough. It was always the most humanitarian form of slaughter. Now suddenly it's not humanitarian enough. This raises a lot of challenges for observant Jews living in Europe.
A couple of things. Some of this is very old. There are countries like Switzerland, which have never allowed shechita, so it's in the Swiss Constitution, which dates back to like the 14th century. So Swiss Jews have had to go over the border to either France or Germany to get their meat and bring it back, and also Swiss kosher restaurants and hotels, likewise. One would think that in certain countries, a better PR effort might result in a better understanding of the laws of kosher slaughtering and how humane they truly are. But I think some of the stuff that passes for being humane, like stunning the animal first, makes sense to people who don't feel bound by this system. And it may even make sense to Jews. There are an awful lot of Jews who find a variety of reasons for not observing the Jewish dietary laws, as you well know. But I would say, before any of your listeners gets the idea, Europe's terribly anti-Semitic, it's a rise of anti-Semitism, look what's going on in California about the circumcision ban and the proposed legislation to ban circumcision and how that will affect both Jews and Muslims there.
Just as this kosher slaughter also affects halal Muslims. We think about Jews and Muslims on the opposite sides, but on these issues, they're on the same team. We're on the same team, I should say.
Yeah, I don't honestly know that much about their laws of slaughtering. I mean, their dietary laws are in some ways similar to ours, and any kosher meat is automatically halal. But I'm not sure that any halal meat is automatically kosher.
It's not.
Right.
But the way that they've structured this law, it would outlaw both. And it's an interesting merger between animal rights groups and right-wing anti-Muslims. I don't think the anti-Semitism is really a major factor. We're just getting trampled in the rush.
Well, it's not consciously, but I think the law in the Swiss Constitution going back many centuries probably was based on anti-Semitism.
And after all, the first law that the Germans passed on the way to the Holocaust was a ban on Shechita, a ban on kosher slaughter.
Right. That's a good point.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. German scientists were digging 150 feet under Munich when they were surprised to discover small pieces of copper. They studied them very carefully and came to the conclusion that the copper from 25,000 years ago had been a nationwide telephone network in ancient Germany. They reported this in scientific journals worldwide. Well, British scientists heard about the German announcement and they were not impressed. They immediately embarked on a project to dig even deeper under London. When they had dug down to 300 feet, they found small pieces of glass. They studied the glass very carefully and came to the conclusion 35,000 years ago there was a nationwide fiber optic network in use by the ancient Britons. Well, Israeli scientists were enraged when they heard of the German and British claims. They decided to dig not 150 feet, not 300 feet, but 600 feet under the ground in Jerusalem. Unfortunately, they found nothing whatsoever. Nevertheless, they came to the conclusion that 55,000 years ago, the ancient Israelites had cellular telephones. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week, we read the second portion of the Book of Devarim, Deuteronomy and the Torah, the remarkable Sedra Vayetchanan. Vayetchanan includes spectacular texts, the Shema, the central statement of God's oneness in the world. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Followed immediately by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all our hearts, mind, and strength. And as if that were not enough for one Torah portion, Vayetchanan also includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, for the second time in the Torah. If you were to rank portions, you could easily put Vayetchanan near the top in quality of content. After all, a portion that includes the essence of monotheism and the Ten Commandments, the centerpiece of all Western ethics, is a pretty spectacular parsha. It is no accident that this powerfully affirming portion is read the week after Tisha B'Av on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation. For we take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness can ultimately bring justice and peace. So, what more can we possibly learn about these most famous texts of our tradition? The Shema itself is really just a simple sentence. Listen, Israel, God is your Lord, God is only one. It's straightforward. Something that should be easy to understand and accept. Wholeness, holistic oneness. So simple, in fact, anyone can understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas often struggle for acceptance. In truth, well over 3,000 years since we Jews first articulated the idea that God is one, less than half the world's population actually believes in the oneness of God. But you know, it's the text that follows the Shema and Vayetchanan, the Ve'ahavta, that is more subtle, in many ways more intriguing. For in that passage, we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. Many things in life can be commanded, but love, it seems to me, is distinctly not one of them. So what does the Torah mean when it says we are commanded to love God? It is a strange idea, but a powerful one. For love is essentially a kind of unconditional way of giving, of focusing attention and caring for another being. Loving God means paying attention to God, to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, to God's moral code for us. In this case, we express our love of God, our ahava, by demonstrating that we have learned how to listen, shma. If we truly listen, then we will know that we must act ethically. In essence, loving God means we're obligated to follow God's mitzvot, to live ethical lives, to do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good, morally good, is a form of love, perhaps the purest form of love. May we all find a way to express that love through the righteous actions of mitzvot, and so come to affirm God in our world. When we come back on to Jewish, author Joan Ligant will tell us how she decided to write about what Americans find in Israel and how they transform and transform Israel too. Find out when we return on to Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz, and I'm here to schmooze about the Jewish news. In Israel, Arabs, Jews, the ultra-Orthodox, the secular, young, and old alike have found common ground in protesting against the rising cost of living. Over the last weekend, there was an estimated 150,000 protesters across the state of Israel. Part of the problem, protesters say, is that in the 1990s, Israel increased its subsidies to settlers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but decreased funding for public construction in Israel proper. As a result, Israel now spends almost 15% of its public construction budget in settlements, despite the fact that only 4% of its population lives there. Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat has also highlighted another cause for the high cost of rent in his city. Many wealthy foreigners, out of a love of Israel, have purchased residences in the city. They come and stay there for a couple of months, or maybe even only a couple of weeks a year. However, because of their involvement in the real estate market, demand for housing has gone up, and so have prices. While their intentions are good, and Mayor Barkat is grateful for their involvement in the city, it has had an unintended side effect. Mayor Barkat's administration is working on encouraging seasonal residents to rent out their space when they are not in the country, and hopefully that will increase the supply of housing and lower prices. In other news, the Reform Jewish movement won a significant legal victory in Israel recently. The Tel Aviv Administrative Court ruled that the city of Netanya must allow the local Reform congregation to have a building of their own. The congregation has been in existence for 30 years, but the mayor of Netanya, fearing backlash from the Orthodox members of her community, refused to allow the congregation space in the city. The court ruling marks a significant civil rights victory, helping Reform Jews to freely practice in their own homeland. This is Rabbi Jason Holtz, and that was the news of Jews.
Welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest, Joan Ligant, the author of the new book, or newish book, Wherever You Go, a very interesting book about Americans moving to Israel, West Bank, and many other questions. She's from New York, grew up in Westbury, Long Island, has an undergraduate degree from Harvard, a law degree from Boston University, and an MFA from Vermont College. She spent 3 years in Jerusalem in her late 20s, practiced law for roughly 10 years before recovering and beginning to write fiction. She taught writing at Harvard for 8 years. First collection of short stories, An Hour in Paradise, was the winner of the Penn New England Book Award and the Edward Lewis Wallant Award, and was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award and lots of other awards. Joan, your book deals with the settlers extensively and people who move to Israel and get involved in sort of religious violence. What kind of research did you do? How were you able to access that community?
Right. That's a great question. The research was sort of based on two or three different aspects. One is as you know, probably if you've, you know, anyone listening to this who spent time in Israel, that you cannot really be there for a very long time before encountering lots of journalism and articles in the press about the phenomenon of Jewish extremism, about the settlers. They're in the news all the time. And so one piece of my research, and what informed my writing here and my thinking, was a daily dose of reading the press. And I don't read it in Hebrew, I read it in English, but nowadays in Israel you can read Haaretz, which is an Israeli newspaper, in English. You can read the Jerusalem Post. Then you can read other, there's lots of other journalism available in English. So for one thing, there was tons of daily coverage, as well as on the news, as well as documentaries. That's one piece. People talk about it constantly in Israel. I live in Tel Aviv when I'm there, and Tel Aviv is a vibrant, largely secular city. People are heavily engaged in politics in Israel. Everybody has an opinion and wants to talk. So there's a great deal of very intelligent and very passionate conversation about of what is going on in the settlements. So there's a great deal of conversation I had with all kinds of people all along the spectrum who really had a great deal to offer me. And then, as I say, there was journalism. I did visit the West Bank. I didn't speak personally to any settlers because I actually don't know any, and I was actually not allowed. I mean, we were turned away from a few settlements that I went with a friend who is an American who has been in Israel for many years. He wears a kippah. He's a rabbi. He has beautiful Hebrew. But we were turned away from numerous places and said, unless you have a personal invitation, you can't come here. But we did visit several others. And I didn't speak directly to people who are there, but when you're there long enough and you watch the news and you read enough, you can hear the conversation, the rhetoric, the way people speak. And so I tried to be as faithful to that as I could in rendering these characters. So I had both a physical observation. You know, I was out in these places. I saw it on the news. I had a fair amount of information from contemporary journalism, and I did read a great deal about the rise of radicalism in Israel, from scholarly writers to contemporary journalists.
You know, it's a little startling. I spent a little time, as sort of a tourist student, going to West Bank town and going to the yeshiva there to study in between my studies at Hebrew Union College. They didn't know I was a Reform rabbinical student, so they, I was just another guy walking in a white shirt. But I will tell you the contrast between people living in places, even like Efrat, which is a pretty well-established place, and, Tel Aviv, where, you work at Bar Ilan, is extraordinary. You really feel like you're on the front lines on a pretty regular basis if you're in the West Bank. I think you captured a fair amount of that in your book. What role does that play in the choices that the people make in your book to be violent, to not be violent, to make the kinds of choices they make? What role does that environment of sort of embattled environment?
Right. It's interesting. I think that these settlements are probably more nuanced than most of us know. You know, they do run along the spectrum. Some are more religious, some are less religious but more what they call nationalist Zionist.
Right.
Some are more secular, some have I think actually the most extremist settlers, some people call them fanatic settlers, I'm not sure, I don't like to use pejoratives, but the more extreme settlers are probably a very small percentage of the people in the West Bank overall, and those were the ones I was most interested in. Those are the individuals that I would say there's a couple of characteristics that would have, therefore, an influence on these characters. One is that they do have a messianism about them that says, this is the land God gave us, and we will only listen to the authority of God. What I am interested in as an American, as a former lawyer, as a law-abiding individual who believes in democracy, what interested me was that many of these individuals in their rhetoric and their positions say that they don't have to answer to a secular authority. So when the Supreme Court of Israel makes a ruling to take down one of the illegal outposts, for example, a straightforward ruling after a long court case sends the army to go out and dismantle this settlement, these are the individuals who will attack the soldiers, throw them off roofs. Or there's an organization called the Hilltop Youth that will come back in 24 hours after one of these outposts is taken down. They come back in and put it back up and say, we do not have to answer to this secular authority. So one element which is interesting is the messianism. And what interests me about that is that radical movements have often taken a messianic position. That's part of fuel some of their passion, you know, socialists and communists. And there's a certain messianism. We're going to save the world. We're going to follow our lights. And this is messianism in the name of God that says we don't have to follow the law. We don't have to follow the institutions of democracy. So that's one type of individual. I'm not sure that those people would articulate that who are living in places like Efrat or Ariel, which have individuals who run across the spectrum there. Sure. So that's one aspect. The other is that there does, as you say, there is an embattled feeling to the individuals living out in some of these more remote areas, and they are living 250,000, 300,000 Israelis among 2.5 million Palestinians, and in somewhat remote places. So they have barbed wire in some cases around these settlements, and they have armed guards. There is an embattlement to it. Now, they create that embattlement by putting themselves in these remote areas among a population of non-Jews. But I think it actually reinforces this desire to feel embattled. It's a little bit of a heroic position. And the third thing I think that is very interesting that has influence on the young Americans is that the settlers, I think, have taken on the mantle of Zionism, that they are the new pioneers. Because Zionism in its heyday, you know, has declined to some degree in the sense of people going out. And, you know, I'm on the older side. I went to Israel in the 70s, and you could still go out and feel like you might contribute inside Israel and build a new settlement in the Galil or in the Negev. And that's changed over the decades. And it's been picked up by the more radical elements who have become the new voices of, you know, to appeal to the young and say, this is where you can put your Zionist fervor. I think there's lots of opportunities for young Americans and young Israelis to do other things that also contribute to Zionist fervor inside Israel. They don't have to take up the settlement cause. But the settlement cause can fulfill that need as well. So I think that appeals to a lot of young Americans who come.
There's a great passion, too. And that, you know, passion often appeals to the young.
Absolutely. And a sense of place and a sense that what you do matters and one individual counts. This and certainly for young Americans who... You know, we live in a large country. Doing anything is like trying to turn around the Queen Elizabeth. It's, you know, where in Israel you feel you can make a difference. You're one person. And in the story, I portray one of these young individuals as a bit of a weak student. And, you know, he wants to go somewhere where they don't care about his bad SAT scores and doesn't matter about his academics, which is also a bit of a commentary on what's available to people in American Jewish life.
You tell me who your major influences have been, your literary influences.
In terms of writing, well,
yes.
I'm pretty steeped heavily in contemporary Jewish American literature. First of all, contemporary American literature is what I do prefer to read anyway. I mean, I read other cultures and I read other decades, other centuries, but I do like to read contemporary American literature. And I'm a huge fan of Bernard Malamud and Philip Roth and Grace Paley and some of these great American Jewish writers for their writing, as well as, of course, I'm engaged by their subjects. But some of those, I would say, those are books that I've read over and over. But I also, throughout the writing of this book, I read Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections twice, and I read another book by Jeffrey Eugenides twice. You know, these are, I admire their writing style. They're vigorous writers who really make the most of a sentence. And so I use those as sort of, in a way, a kind of inspiration to write as well as I could.
I play a little game sometimes with Jewish novels. We have a book group, I lead the book group, and I look and see if there are mistakes in the Jewish stuff, because and I don't necessarily share them, but you know, most writers are pretty faithful. What did you do to get the Jewish stuff right? Because you pretty much do.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's interesting. I myself have, I'm 60 years old, so I feel like I've been through many incarnations, and I have studied Jewish texts since my late 20s. I myself went to Pardes, which is a modern yeshiva, we'll call it,
right,
in Jerusalem.
An excellent pluralistic yeshiva, I would say.
Yes. And I was there for 2 years in that first stint in Jerusalem that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So I did study there for 2 years, and it put me on a path of studying text for a long time, and I've been very active in my own minyan. So I'm actually, you know, over the years I've learned a fair amount. And then what I don't know, I do research, and I live in a pretty, let's say, knowledgeable and broad Jewish world here in the Boston area. So I did ask other people for some. There are a few Talmudic references I needed some help with, and I had lots of people I could ask. But I did call upon some of what I kind of have learned over the years. That's actually part of the pleasure of writing. You get to call upon all kinds of sources that you've buried away in your unconscious or your memory, and they come up and help you.
I want to thank Joan Lee Gant for a great visit on Two Jewish. Her book, Wherever You Go, has been chosen one of the significant books by the Reform Movement, Rabbi Eric Yaffe's special list, and it's a great book, very interesting. People can find it pretty much wherever books are sold. What's your website?
Yes, it's www.joanleegant.com. And the book will be coming out in paperback in July.
It's L-E-E-G-A-N-T. Thanks very much, Joan.
Thank you.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, lots of restaurants offer great food and service, but not all restaurants also offer life lessons. For example, learning to share is a lesson that families try to instill in their kids at an early age. At Mama's, we're here to help. For example, order a slice of pepperoni pizza. One hungry person can definitely eat it, but it's pretty huge, which means you could share it with your kid. What a great example you'd be setting. You're sharing something that you love with someone you love. Or get a family-sized calzone. It's really huge. When your family is stuffed, you could share the leftovers with your parents-in-law. It's a generous act that demonstrates your kindness and also might earn you several nights of babysitting. Or order a slice of Mama's delicious cheesecake. The portion is generous, which means, nah, let's not go overboard with the sharing idea. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, we'll celebrate our 9th anniversary of Two Jewish with a very special show. Don't miss the bells, whistles, shtick, and celebration of this great simcha. It happens only once a year, next Sunday at 9 a.m. Or, of course, on podcasts and from our TwoJewishRadio.com website forever. But listen to it live anyway. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli star Rami Kleinstein and his song Tapuchim V'Tmarim, Apples and Dates. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
מוציאה עוד ממחתה הרוכלים לה צועקים מה קרה לחמודה זה אהובי שלא רוצה הוא מצא לו נערה קחי לך תפוחים ותמרים המתיקי את יומך, הוא לא שווה את הכל שמתרוצץ אצלך בלב. היא אוהבת את האיש שלא אוהב אותה, סמלת פרחים לחיים שושנים, לך לא מספיקים. אתה רוצה אישה בלקת בלי ניסיון חיים, אתה רוצה ילדה נערה קפואה ובלי קמטים. קחי לך תפוחים ודמרים, המתיקי את יומך, הוא לא שווה דקר שמתרוצץ אצלך בלב. נה 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 נה. והיא פה מחכה בין דוכני שווקים, שאתה תרצה אותה אהובה רק שנוח ומדהים.